Unified Council, welcome. My client's parents who are in the courtroom, and of course, Mr. McMorris. I'm the attorney for him. My name is Bo McGraw. Appreciate the opportunity that this was placed on the court's calendar this morning. I know originally it wasn't set for oral arguments, so we appreciate that. So in preparation for today, this is what I don't quite understand. Typically, when we have these cases, we come before the court and we're fighting over why a case is time-barred or why isn't it time-barred. I went back through the timing on this case as I prepared this morning, and I'm puzzled as to why there's arguments relative to why my client can't present these issues pursuant to a post-conviction relief petition. First, it's been my experience that any time that there's allegations of an attorney standard that falls below the accepted standard of care, it's something that's developed on a post-conviction relief petition. The reason it's developed on a post-conviction relief petition is because that is not part of the record at the point of the conclusion of the original trial. Therefore, it's not ripe for appeal. In this case, what I understand is, I understand that my client's principal right to appeal, a ruling was provided, an opinion for this court, on May 6th of 2019. Then I understand that he filed a post-conviction relief petition alleging ineffective assistance of counsel, supported by an affidavit of a forensic pathologist. I understand he did that on May 4 of 2021. What does the law tell us about post-conviction relief petitions? They must, at a minimum, be filed without going into the exceptions within 2 years of the conclusion of your appeal. We checked that box. He did that. We're timely. We're here, and we're timely. Okay? So what did the district court say? Presented with that petition, presented with an expert report from a forensic pathologist, and what did that expert report talk about? It went to the very crux of the state's case.
Am I wrong, Mr. McGraw? But in the direct appeal, did he not raise, at least in one of his arguments, an ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
Yeah.
I think what they're going to say is if you got one, you got to raise them all. And, I think that's kind of right. But,
I would respectfully disagree.
And as to the whole expert thing, you can always hire a better expert, or there are always better experts, but isn't that sort of, apart from whether it's time barred or not, and whether it should have been, whether NAFLA cuts in, that seems to me the choice of the expert you hired, this guy versus this woman, who has these credentials versus that credentials, who's going to say this, is going to say that. Isn't that the essence of trial strategy, which is something we never look at in terms of effective assistance of counsel?
It might be, and it probably is. But let's unpackage this question, because it's two parts.
Well, then, don't you lose then?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Well,
let me
just
tell me why I'm wrong.
Yep, let me unpack both parts. Okay, first of all, so your first question wasn't there a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel made in the direct appeal? The answer to that question, Your Honor, is respectfully yes. What was the nature of that claim? The same lawyer that provided counsel to Mr. McMorris during his trial proceedings, said I might have been ineffective at parts of the proceeding. But then what did the lawyer say next? It wasn't some fulsome examination of the attorney's full conduct relative to that representation. The lawyer said, and I would invite you to look back at that appeal, I suspect you have, but what the lawyer said was, I may have been ineffective at parts, but the reason I was ineffective is because I got poor decisions from the district court. And so my hands were tied, and I couldn't fully present my client's case the way I wanted to. That was the full extent of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim that was made to the district court. Let's address your second question now, Your Honor. Your second question was, what goes to trial strategy and what doesn't? What I'm asking for today is a remand to the district court. The reason I'm asking for a remand to the district court is, first of all, I haven't seen many post-conviction relief petitions where it's been alleged that there's been ineffective assistance of counsel, that the district court hasn't acknowledged that to get to the right side of that issue, we need a more fulsome record, or at least a record developed relative to the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, which arose after the trial was concluded. Now, what we might find out during that hearing, which we haven't had, which wasn't granted in this case, I submit it should have been, what we don't have then is we don't know why the lawyer made the decision the lawyer made relative to the expert. We've contended in this...
Well, I mean, what is fine. So you get a hearing. And yep. Let's say the lawyer testifies, you know, had I known everything I know now, I would have hired the expert you've presented rather than the expert I hired. I mean, that's... How does that get you anywhere? I mean, it's sort of like...
I don't know if he would say that. But if he did say that, then we would probably get into that a little deeper. And what we would ask him is, we would say, were you aware at the time of trial that the state's theory of the case was that this child was physically harmed by somebody within 3 hours of the child's death, between 1 and 3 hours? We would ask the lawyer that.
But there was testimony from Dr. Opphoven at the trial about sickle cell, about these alternatives. So I guess I'm not sure what additionally, what the difference is. And then it wasn't clear to me from your briefing either, what's the difference in credentials? Because I reviewed the CVs for both your expert and for the trial, defense trial expert. So I'd like a little more information on that.
It's my understanding that Dr. Shundru is a forensic pathologist that is uniquely qualified to provide testimony relative to this issue. And we provide this in our brief. It's provided in his affidavit. What would Dr. Shundru say about this time period, which is so important because the facts, as alleged, say that it was Mr. McMorris that was last left with this child.
But they're both certified in... board certified in forensic pathology.
They are.
So
they are.
What is, and there's a big point in your brief about this, what is the certification or qualification that Dr. Shundru has that Dr. Opphoven did not?
He was uniquely qualified to testify about the timing of the alleged assault in relation to the timing of the death. That's the uniqueness of his testimony, and that's what's in his
where
affidavit.
Where does that come from, though? Where do I find that? Where do I find that, I guess? Because I didn't see that, really, in the briefing or what was...
I've attached his report to our addendum, Your Honor.
Yeah, and I read. Okay, go on.
And so that's
but
that's
I read
where
it's in the report, is what you're saying, and that because, okay, all right, go ahead.
And the timing really was the crux of this case. So here, what, yeah. I just want to make sure the record is clear on this point. So this is what Dr. Shundru would have testified to. He would have said that without an eyewitness or a video recording of the blunt force trauma, it is impossible for any medical examiner, let alone a pediatric surgeon, which was the primary expert of the state, to pinpoint the length of time it took the child to, quote, bleed out. So to get back to Your Honor's question about how we would develop this at a hearing with the other attorney, what we would do is we'd have, and what Dr. Shundru says is that there's publication after publication in this regard. That's what he says in his report. I've contained that in my brief. So then I get to have a discussion representing Mr. McMorris about what work the lawyer did to properly prepare and represent Mr. McMorris as it relates to the most important issue of the case, the timing of when this child was assaulted before the child passed on. And we just don't know that story because we don't have any record. The reason we put a hearing like this, a matter like this on for
hearing. And the fact that you don't know that story and the fact that those allegations about whether counsel's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness and then in addition satisfied the second Strickland prong, where's that in the post-conviction petition? Because when I look at the standard of review, when I look at burdens of proof, your client has the burden of proof in the petition to allege all of those things.
I didn't represent Mr. McMorris at the time the petition was drafted in this case. I took the case up on appeal. My understanding...
But you're stuck with it. You're stuck with the petition.
I'm stuck with it. And I think the petition satisfies what needs to be satisfied for us to properly allege these claims. He alleged that his attorney was ineffective. He alleged in the petition that the attorney was ineffective in that the attorney didn't do what was necessary to attack the issue that I've spent the time this morning talking about, this time of death. This 1 to 3 hour window on whether or not the theory of the case presented by the state that this child bled out during that period is something that the lawyer did the work necessary to protect Mr. McMorris' interests. That's contained in that petition. It's probably not contained in that same way because I didn't draft it, but it's contained in that petition. It's clear in that petition that Mr. McMorris, through counsel, alleged that his prior attorney was ineffective. What else we know, and I think this is important, is this idea that that the district court says, well, you can't come before me and talk about ineffective assistance of counsel because your prior attorney, who happened to be your appellate attorney, also brought the issue up before the Court of Appeals on direct appeal. We have a case that speaks to that issue. It's JAMA v. State. And what is JAMA saying? I'm referring to page 6 of my reply brief. I write in here, in JAMA, the Court of Appeals held that where trial and appellate counsel are the same, we conclude that for purposes of NAFLA, failure to raise issues of ineffective assistance of counsel is presumptively neither deliberate nor inexcusable, and that in fairness, further review should not be barred. I think I can't think of any more guidance that we would need on this issue than from that case.
So what is your, what cases do you rely on the most for setting aside the NAFLA bar issue and going right to the merits? For saying that these kinds of issues aren't trial strategy, because that's what the district court relied on. When the district court actually analyzed the merits of the issues raised,
it might end up being trial strategy. In fairness, we could have a hearing, and we could lose. The district court could determine, based upon a record where we actually address this issue, that the record supports a finding that the attorney was not ineffective and that the attorney made decisions that it falls into this protected bubble that attorneys all enjoy, where our errors sometimes can be packed up in, quote, trial strategy. That might happen. I don't know. My point is, and it just dawned on me really this morning when I started preparing for this, I can't think of another case where I've alleged ineffective assistance of counsel, especially within the two-year period, where I haven't had a hearing. And the reason that we have hearings is because we understand when someone's liberty is at stake and we have a death of an individual, which we have to get right. We have to get right for the decedent and the decedent's family. We have to get right for the individual whose liberty has been taken. All we're asking for is a hearing to develop an issue that is not a part of any record.
So on the expert witness issue, we've got the supplemental report that Dr. Shunderu did. So the hearing would not go further down that path, correct?
I would want to call Dr. Shundra because I would want to make sure that, for two reasons. Number one, I want to lay appropriate foundation for the report and make sure that we've got an adequate record. I might want Dr. Shundra to explain on some of the theories that he espouses in that affidavit. And I want to give the state an opportunity to cross-examine our witness. So I'd want to maybe present that testimony. Okay, but a lot of my experience with post-conviction hearings is we kind of get that and then we move past it and then we get to the lawyer and the lawyer testifies. And we have an opportunity to ask the lawyer questions about how the lawyer chose that expert. And again, it might get packaged away and protected. It might be attorney decision, strategy type stuff. But it might not be. And we're talking about 2 hours of a court's time to get to the bottom of this issue. I'm asking that you remand this case, allowing for such a hearing to occur. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McGraw. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Counsel for the state.
Good
deep breath.
May it please the court, my name is Annika Johnson, and I'm a certified student attorney from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office on behalf of the state of Minnesota. My supervising attorney, John Schmidt, is present in the courtroom with me. The post-conviction court did not abuse its discretion by denying appellant relief on claims of ineffective assistance of trial counsel and ineffective assistance of appellant counsel. The allegations at issue are all matters of trial strategy that this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have continually said are not reviewable. The post-conviction court correctly concluded that even absent a procedural bar, the request for relief of the ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims fail because they are matters of trial strategy. Appellant has not satisfied the two-part test under Strickland v. Washington and did not carry the burden of showing deficient performance and prejudice. Under Strickland v. Washington, appellant must prove that counsel's representation fell below an objective standard of reasonableness and that there is a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the results of the proceeding would have been different. Appellant has not done this. Further, appellant cannot establish that his appellate counsel was ineffective for not raising on appeal meritless claims that his trial counsel was ineffective. In the Minnesota Supreme Court case of Evans v. State, counsel does not act unreasonably by excluding claims that counsel could have legitimately concluded would not prevail. Further, appellant brings in a claim on post-conviction appeal for the first time of newly discovered evidence. This is forfeited on appeal because it was not raised in the post-conviction petition.
So, excuse me for a minute. So is the state maintaining, is the state's position that these issues are not flabbard?
The state's position is not that these issues are not flabbard because this court said in JAMA when trial counsel and appellate counsel are the same person, they are not barred. But the state is asking this court to affirm on the grounds that, like the post-conviction court stated, even absent a procedural bar, these claims still fail on the merits because they're all matters of trial strategy.
Thank you.
So with this newly discovered evidence claim, like I said, it's forfeited on...
How do we know, though, that it's a matter of trial strategy in the absence of an evidentiary hearing where counsel for the petitioner has an opportunity to examine the attorney who represented Mr. McMorris at trial?
We know that these are matters of trial strategy because... there are decisions that a reasonable attorney could make, and there haven't been claims made by appellant that prove the two prongs of Strickland, and that's the test that needs to be satisfied.
What was the trial strategy in not objecting to the autopsy photos?
The trial strategy there is allowing the jury to have the full evidence presented before them. Those are facts that are necessary in order to reach a just outcome. And it's within the discretion of a trial attorney.
So you think it's a good idea? So it was a brilliant trial strategy to let the jury, in the interest of seeing all the evidence, see the pictures of the dead child? You don't think that would... I mean, I would think... I would think, the big argument was always the pictures, the bloody pictures, the dead child, the dead person... And normally, those are objected to for a whole variety of reasons, and then, you have the argument, well, you can have one picture, not three, blah, blah, blah. Explain to me, what was the argument, what was the trial strategy, again, involved in not objecting to the autopsy photos? Ms. Johnson.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm not saying that this is a brilliant trial strategy, but I'm saying it's within that attorney's discretion to make that decision to... allow those...
Well, would the argument be there was no dispute that the child was dead? The dispute was over the alternative perpetrator arguments and the timing of the child's deaths. And to that extent, the autopsy pictures would not have been either helpful or hurtful to that issue if that was the key issue for the defense at trial.
Yeah, that's correct. There was no dispute about the child's death, and they were looking more at evidence that would suggest, like you said, alternative perpetrators. That's correct.
And could it be possible that it fell below standards to pick this particular expert who got beaten up pretty badly on cross-examination? I mean, I don't have it in the record. I don't know what it was, but there was some letter in 2007, apparently, and it looked bad when I was reading the transcript. So couldn't that fall below?
Your Honor,
there was a hearing, and that was brought out?
Your Honor, the expert that was called to testify at trial was a board-certified forensic pathologist, same as this new expert that the state appellant wants to bring in. And this was a local forensic pathologist, so that's a reasonable strategy on the part of trial counsel to not bring in someone from Texas, which is what appellant wants to do now. And while the expert may not have given the most perfect...
But there's no case law talking about geography. I mean, some of the best experts are not located... I mean, we've got high quality here in the state of Minnesota, but there are people with expertise elsewhere.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. But that doesn't mean that it was unreasonable to have someone who is local, who is also board certified, who has the same credentials as this new doctor that appellant is wanting to bring in. If this court has no further questions, then the state would respectfully request that this court affirm the post-conviction court, and the state will rest on its response brief.
Any other questions from the panel this morning?
No, thank you.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. Mr. McGraw?
Briefly. So I started out my argument saying that I didn't think Mr. McMorris's petition was NAFLBARD. The state seems to agree that it's not NAFLBARD, but the district court opined otherwise. And here's what the district court said specifically. So this is really the crux of what this court needs to determine is proper or not proper. Petitioner, this is a quote, this is from the order that we seek relief from. Petitioner attempts to circumvent the procedural bar by arguing that his appellate counsel, who was also his trial counsel, was not in a position to effectively argue on appeal that he was ineffective during trial. I go on. In doing so, petitioner asked this court to consider his ineffective assistance claim under the interest of justice exception to NAFLA. But petitioner fails to establish that his claims have substantive merit, so they are barred by NAFLA. Now, compare that, which is...
Well, I mean, that's true if they're all trial strategy. If we decide that all the issues relate to trial strategy, then they don't have substantive merit because, you know, we don't second-guess trial strategy for post-conviction relief. I mean, would that be a fair statement, Mr. McGraw?
And I would respectfully submit, Your Honor, you don't have the record before you to make that conclusion. Here's what JAMA says in comparison to the court. I'm going to be brief because I've read it twice now. JAMA says... Where trial and appellate counsel are the same, we conclude that for purposes of NAFLA, failure to raise the claims of ineffective assistance of counsel is presumptively neither deliberate nor inexcusable, and that, in fairness, further review should not be barred. That flies directly in the face of the district court's conclusion. The JAMA ruling is a ruling of this court. Unless there's further questions, I'll conclude my remarks.
All right, thank you. Anything else from the panel this morning? All right, thank you very much. Counsel, the matter is submitted. Thank you very much for your submissions. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time period. Thank you.